and welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
Being an investor sounds good, doesn't it? Who wouldn't want to be an investor? It sounds like you're a kind of benefactor. But actually, in practice, a lot of investment, perhaps the majority of investment, is purely extractive.
We discuss why we can't afford the rich, and we challenge ideas about wealth, entrepreneurialism, and investment. There's no time for Tax Justice News headlines this month. We're going to go straight to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month's big news. Okay, John, we've seen a tax justice leap forwards this month of real global significance. And we've talked a lot about the British satellite havens and how, because of them, the UK's financial secrecy network is actually the biggest in the world. And that's because the City of London outsources its secrecy to the so-called Crown dependencies and overseas territories. And that way it can maintain relatively moderate secrecy levels, according to the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. Now, the British Parliament has voted to oblige its overseas territories, so that's places like the Cayman Islands, number 3 in the Financial Secrecy Index, and the British Virgin Islands, to make available public registers of the real owners of companies. And the British government was apparently quite busy assuring these overseas territories not to worry about this vote because it just wasn't going to happen. But in the end, they just had to accept they were going to lose the vote, and the vote carried. Very good news, but there are several caveats here, aren't there? Not least what we're always saying about trusts and foundations, which remain shrouded in secrecy. And we'll talk about some of the other issues in a minute. But what's your initial reaction to the vote, first of all?
Well, my initial reaction is that this is great news. We've been campaigning on this for decades. I think Tax Justice Network was the first organisation that was really pushing for full public registry of beneficial ownership information. This is a really important step forward in tackling global corruption, in tackling tax evasion. It's a massive win. I think it's important to flag up that this amendment was carried through Parliament, promoted by a cross-party grouping. I think that's very important because for a long time, I think that the overseas territories and Crown dependencies have assumed that they've carried a parliamentary majority, particularly amongst Conservatives. But when it came to the day, a sufficiently large number of Conservative backbenchers were prepared to support this anti-corruption measure, and the government was forced to back down. That's very good news. The caveats, yes, big issue of concern immediately is that the amendment at this stage relates only to the overseas territories. It must be extended to the Crown dependencies. And we need to address the issue of what happens next to the overseas territories in the Caribbean, because they're going to be finding themselves without any basis for their economy once the tax haven side starts to diminish.
OK, and let's talk about the constitutional arrangements around this whole vote, because arguments were always made over many years that the British government doesn't have jurisdiction over the overseas territories or the Crown dependencies. And in fact, in this vote, the Crown dependencies, so that's Jersey, Guernsey, Isle of Man, they were left out of the amendment. Tell us why they were left out of this amendment.
Well, it appears that they were left out of the amendment because there was a misunderstanding, possibly on the part of parliamentary advisers, about whether or not the UK Parliament has the ability to extend legislation or impose legislation onto the Crown dependencies. There seems no doubt whatsoever about the ability of the UK Parliament to extend or impose legislation on the overseas territories. But in the case of the Crown dependencies, Jersey, Guernsey, Isle of Man, by convention, the UK government prefers not to impose but to agree. And so there are normally long periods of consultation before anything happens. And typically the islands would agree. That didn't happen. David Cameron, Prime Minister, in 2015, asked the islands to make their registries public. They declined to do so. And they have continued to decline to do so. So Parliament has decided to impose it. Now, do they have the constitutional right to do that? They do. In my opinion, there are two sources we can refer to which suggests that the UK Parliament has the authority to extend legislation to the Crown dependencies. The first is the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the UK Constitution, which reported in 1973. It's typically called the Kilbrandon Commission, after Lord Kilbrandon, who chaired that commission. And they concluded that whilst by convention Parliament prefers to not impose, it has the authority to do so. And crucially, if national security issues are involved, it must do so. And let's get back to that in a second. Also, in 2014, the Supreme Court looked at these arrangements and came to a very similar conclusion. In other words, Parliament does have the authority to extend or impose legislation on the Crown dependencies. It's a pretty clear-cut situation. And it's quite possible that the MPs who are pushing forward the amendment have been misadvised by parliamentary advisers.
So actually, in some ways, this was a missed opportunity because they could have got the Crown dependencies and the overseas territories in one go, in one vote, to open up their registers of real owners. And that didn't happen.
Yes, that's right. It didn't happen, and this does look like a missed opportunity, and it could be a missed opportunity which causes huge embarrassment to the UK government, because look at the situation as we have it now. Overseas territories are now being required to make their ownership registries publicly available online, which will have, in a number of cases, particularly British Virgin Islands, a devastating effect on their economy, whilst the Crown dependencies are not currently facing that requirement. And that looks quite discriminatory. From any angle you look at it, it looks as if a discriminatory position has been arrived at, which favours the Crown dependencies and puts the overseas territories in a very difficult position.
Right, you can understand why they might feel a bit miffed that they've been targeted in this way, given the history of Britain's really terrible treatment of some of these island nations. The islands have suffered a lot from what the Tax Justice Network calls the finance curse, since Britain encouraged them to become tax havens in the first place. So it really is the least that Britain can do at this point to assist the overseas territories in diversifying and formulating a plan B now.
Well, you've touched on a number of really important matters there. Britain encouraged many of the Caribbean islands, once they had opted to stay within the UK dependency, to go down the route of becoming tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions. And the reason for this appears to be because the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which has responsibility for these islands, didn't want to incur large aid dependency on their part. So they were encouraging them to go down the route of becoming tax havens. And of course, it was largely British bankers, British lawyers and accounting firms that were going to these islands, setting up their offices and taking over the domestic economies. And as you rightly said, now they find themselves in a position where they don't have much in the way of alternative industrial sectors. Tourism's been weakened by the high local cost bases. Real estate is very high. Construction costs are very high. Local wage rates are high, particularly for the more experienced people. So it makes it very difficult for them to diversify their economies. This is what we talk about when we talk about the finance curse, which means they're stuck and they do need a plan B. Now, I've been talking with the Foreign Office about Plan B for at least 20 years. I've been flagging this up as an issue. I've written about it in the Commonwealth publications and so on. But nothing in practice seems to have happened. It's always been assumed that the government will resist attempts, either by the opposition or external attempts, to actually make the islands adopt proper anti-money laundering regulations. Now that it's happened, most of these islands don't have Plan B, and I would therefore suggest that the UK government has a moral and, crucially, an international responsibility to now help them to prepare for industrial diversification into areas where they can substitute tourism and other activities for their over-reliance on financial services.
Right, and one of the interesting reactions from some of the overseas territories was that dirty money would now flow to even less well-regulated places, to which one might respond that if their model does not attract dirty money, then they don't need to worry about it flowing to even less well-regulated places. But, I mean, this is all about squeezing the secrecy space and making it smaller and smaller and harder for people to hide their money. And let's talk about enforcement, because Britain already brought in public registers of the real owners of companies in 2017. And there's a really important point that we should discuss, which is that really you can pass all sorts of laws and amendments and changes like this, but nothing is going to work without proper resources put into enforcement, like verification and policing. And lots of people have pointed out, quite rightly, that the United Kingdom's public registers are all very well and good, but in Companies House, the British Companies Register, only 20 people oversee 4 million companies. And I think 1 in 10 companies registered actually fail to name their owner or a person of significant control in that register, and nothing happens about it.
Well, that's absolutely right. And as a matter of great urgency, Companies House must be radically transformed. It must have much more resource, and that means experienced staffing available to them to do the job that they should be doing. Because it's been demonstrated time and time again that it's far too easy for anyone to set up a company in the UK and not effectively verify the information they provide or update the information they provide. I think in addition to staffing for Companies House, there should be more pressure on company directors to accept that they have a duty under law to make sure the information they provide is correct and is kept up to date. And if they don't do that, then there should be sanctions against them, including, I don't see why this shouldn't be the case, including sanctions which block them from being directors, not just for 1 or 2 years, but for many years, you know, because that's an important and powerful sanction. But there's absolutely no reason why the smaller British overseas territories and crown dependencies shouldn't be able to, first of all, make their registries public. By that I mean searchable online, ideally at no cost whatsoever to the whoever's doing the searching. And secondly, to ensure that all the information that's on the registry is verified, ideally by a notary or someone of authority who can say this information is correct and this information is being kept up to date. That could be a much smaller task for the islands because, of course, none of them have a company registry anything near the scale of the registry of the of UK itself.
Right, and just one final point. They say that it's an ill wind that blows no one any good, and one of the big beneficiaries could be that some of the dirty money will be driven out of the overseas territories, whether or not the enforcement is in place. It's still an incentive for that dirty money to move away to places like Delaware. So all the better then that the United States is looking a little bit more likely that it might be blacklisted by the European Union.
Yeah, that's a very interesting twist. And they're talking about this happening within the next 12 months. It might happen as early as mid-2019, that the European Union, dissatisfied with the lack of progress that the US has made towards becoming A, more transparent, and B, more cooperative with other international institutions, decides to blacklist it. That would be a truly astonishing thing to happen, but very welcome. But can I just get back to this issue about money moving elsewhere? It's been recognised this month by the UK Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee that the UK is particularly prone to dirty money flows from all sorts of places. Famously, London has become the money launderer's destination of choice, making Britain particularly vulnerable to, for example, Russian oligarch money able to exert quite important pressure, political pressure, on UK government. And what the Foreign Affairs Committee has recognised is that this makes Britain vulnerable to external political manipulation. And they've identified it as a national security threat and said, look, Britain needs to strengthen its own arrangements, and at the same time, it now needs to extend the requirement for public registry to all of his overseas territories and crown dependencies because they are national security threats to the UK itself. And I think that's a very important factor to recognise, and it's going to increase the public pressure on UK Parliament to extend the recent amendment to cover the crown dependencies.
Thanks, John. John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. According to new research by Anglicare in Australia, tax concessions for the richest fifth of the population have reached 68 billion Aussie dollars a year. They estimate it's costing every worker in that country $37 a week. And that's based on how much it costs Australians to give tax concessions for people to go to private schools, use private hospitals, use trusts, and take advantage of capital gains tax breaks on property or real estate. There's a whole lot more that could be added to that list that'd make that final figure even bigger than that. And research in many other countries around the world tells us we're living through a wealth inequality crisis. And there's a whole belief system that's dominated thinking in recent decades, with all sorts of concepts behind it that aren't really questioned, right at the root of the whole thing. This month on the TaxCast, I'm talking to Lancaster University's Professor of Social Theory and Political Economy, Andrew Sayer, who wrote the book Why We Can't Afford the Rich. In your book, you talk about the return of the rich in the last 40 years, the turning point being the 1980s. We've arrived at the point where we are today, where most of us are living in a plutocracy. But it's not just the rule by the rich for the rich. It's also about a whole culture of ideas and the way we think about the economy and tax and wealth, entrepreneurialism, investment. Perhaps we could start with talking about unearned income versus earned income.
Yeah. Earned income, I say, is income which is conditional upon producing goods and services. I don't mean to say what you get is equal to the contribution to the production of goods and services that you've made, just that you don't get paid unless you contribute directly or indirectly to producing some goods and services. Nobody's going to employ you if they don't think you're going to do that. And so unless you make a contribution to producing goods and services, you don't get paid. You don't get taken on, or you can't sell what you've got. You don't have anything to sell. Unearned income, by contrast, just by controlling something, even if you haven't produced it, even if it's already paid for, so land or some spare money, by renting that land out or renting the money out, i.e. lending the money, you can get some unearned income. People who need that, who don't have any land, for example, will pay you some rent. You can make them pay you rent, and that's payment for nothing. It's a free lunch, basically. The land was already there. I'm not talking about the costs paying for land to be improved, say, drained and fertilized. That's different. There, some goods and services have been produced. You know, the land has been improved. Okay, but rent, which is over and above maintenance costs or improvement costs, is something for nothing, basically. It's a function of power, of control of an asset which other people need. But it extends beyond land to property, to buildings and such like. So if I buy a second house and rent it out, even though that second house has already been built and paid for, I can rent it out and get some income for that, and without doing anything, basically. I might do some maintenance for it, but payment for that is different from pure rent, which is just payment in response to control of an asset which other people need. It's based upon power, not contribution. It also applies to monopoly internet platforms like Amazon and Facebook. Just by controlling something which other people want to use or feel obliged to use, perhaps, you have tremendous power. And in those cases, they get the rent not so much from the users as from advertisers and so on.
You make the point that governments prefer to tax earned income rather than unearned income. Why do you think that is?
It is very interesting, and I think it's partly, as any get-rich book will tell you, if you really want to get rich, it's not enough to work hard. You've got to get hold of some assets which will bring you in some what they usually call passive income. Well, that's just a euphemism for unearned income. And if you get lots of that, and you become very rich, you have a lot of political power. You are super rich, especially. It doesn't really surprise me that the political system is skewed towards the interests of the rich. And people, there are some very strange attitudes towards earned and unearned income. I mean, one form of unearned income is inheritances, deceased parents. Then you haven't done anything to deserve that necessarily. It's just a gift. People who tend to get those significant inheritances are usually already from a well-off family or rich family. A lot of people think that it's unfair to tax inheritance, but they have no objection to taxing income, earned income, where you've actually produced something, you've worked hard to get that income. It's just what's become normalized and what hasn't, really. And I think unearned income should be taxed at least at the same rate as earned income, if not more. A lot of people may object to what I've just been saying, and by saying, well, the rich, and even the super rich, are mostly the working rich today. They work, true. And so they say, well, that's earned income, isn't it? Well, actually, the rich and super rich are heavily concentrated in finance and property, and their job is rent seeking or rent extraction. They're continually looking for new sources of rent, new sources of interest on credit, and ways of expanding the flow, increasing the amount, basically. And they're not actually producing goods and services. So I would say that their salaries are basically indirectly unearned income.
Okay. That kind of brings me to ask you about this era of financialized capitalism we're living in, which is basically making money out of money itself. You talk about use value versus exchange value. TaxCast listeners, you really need to read the book. And you interrogate the word investor and investment quite a lot, which is really interesting, because when you actually look at shareholders and what's going on there, it's not really the little people, contrary to the belief about popularizing capitalism in the 1980s. It's usually large institutions and banks, and you use the term gamblers. And 97% of share dealing is secondhand. That money's not going directly into the company to actually invest in that way. It's going to the person who sold you the share. It's no wonder economies in the world are in so much trouble.
Yeah, can I deal with investment first and before shareholding? Because the investment is such a very interestingly slippery word. And so as investment as wealth creation, where the money that you're putting forward goes to fund something new, like infrastructure, new technology, training people so they can do new things. There's something that you're investing in, and it's real. You've actually constructed something that new, which is useful or contributed to that. But then there's a second sense of investor and investment, which is totally different, which is looking at it from the point of view of the investor and what they get out of funding something or putting money into something. So if I buy a second house in the hope that its price will rise and I'll be able to cash in later on in my life, I'm not creating anything. I'm involved in absolutely no wealth creation whatsoever. But people think of that as an investment and sort of pat themselves on the back for doing such things, investing in such things. They're just involved in wealth extraction, producing nothing. And for them, the gains which they make to have any value, again, somewhere else in the economy, maybe not just in this country, but worldwide, other people must be producing goods and services that you can buy with it. So, you know, if I put some money into buying some shares, as you said, in almost all cases, I'm buying them secondhand from somebody else who previously owned them. So the money goes then to them, not to BP or Marks and Spencer or whatever their shares in. So I'm not investing in those companies in the sense of wealth creating investment at all. Possibly, if other people are doing the same thing, that may push the price up of BP shares or Marks and Spencer shares, but it doesn't necessarily result in any objective new productive investment. And passing off investment in the second extractive sense as really the same as the first is an extraordinary bit of ideological slippage, if you like. You know, being an investor sounds good, doesn't it? Who wouldn't want to be an investor? It sounds like you're a kind of benefactor, but actually, in practice, a lot of investment, perhaps the majority of investment, is purely extractive. And even private banks, about 85% of their lending is against existing property, especially mortgages. And they're not actually investing much at all in new productive investment. They'd rather invest against something which already exists. So that it's mainly the extractive kind of investment which private banks go in for.
And ordinary people have kind of been thrown into this shareholder business unawares in lots of ways, because there was a sort of a wave of privatisation of pensions in the UK, at least, and many other countries, which drove some of this shareholder dominance over the market, right?
Yes, that's been encouraged. Yes, people's workplace pensions are generally invested in government bonds, in shares, and in more speculative investments, even by hedge funds and so on. So a lot of the profits of those pension funds is basically unearned income, just on the basis of controlling assets like shares. And so ordinary people's pension income comes to depend upon the financial sector. So it's hard to cut down the financial sector to size, because a lot of people's pensions depend upon it. And also maybe to some extent house prices too. So yes, a lot of the better off part of the population in particular, whose futures are kind of locked into the future of the financial sector.
Let's talk about the role of debt and how that drives economies. In the book, you say in the last 40 years, the world's been more successful at creating claims on wealth rather than wealth itself. And you use the word usury quite a lot, which is interesting. It's kind of an old religious term that went out of fashion.
Yes, interest on lending money. There's a kind of pragmatic justification for it. One is that the only way people will lend out spare cash is if you give them a bit of a return on it. But a lot of the majority of lending for people to buy houses and cars and things like that is just money created by the banks. It's not lending out other people's money, not acting as intermediaries between savers and borrowers. They're creating new money, private banks. But they're allowed to earn interest on that, or gain interest on that, I should say. And it depends upon how high the interest rate are. I mean, 1 or 2% doesn't sound very much, but a lot of store cards have interest rates of over 20%, and then there's payday loans, which may be over 1,000%, extraordinary. And usually these days we reserve the word usury for the higher rates of interest, a usurious rate of interest, we say, exploitative. Credit has been around for thousands of years, and it's been resented where it's involved paying interest, especially high interest, obviously. And both the religious and secular critiques of usury boil down to one thing. Namely, the problem with usury is that it allows the strong, those with spare cash or who can create money, to take advantage of the weak. And, you know, if you think about this in terms of, say, lending money to a friend, you know, if you had a friend who's hard up and says, can I borrow £1,000? If you were then to say, OK, I'll lend you £1,000, but it'll be at 5% interest. And if you don't pay me back by a certain date, I will seize some of your possessions equivalent to what you owe me. That would be the end of the friendship, wouldn't it? And it would seem utterly outrageous and completely clear that you, the lender, were in a position of strength, were taking advantage of their weakness by charging them interest. But at low rates of interest, then it's not too much to worry about. But actually, often the rates of interest are very high. And interest tends to transfer wealth from the poor to the rich. And in countries like Britain and Germany, it's only the top 10% who actually receive more in interest on their savings than they pay out. And most of those who have a net gain, get lots of interest and don't pay much out, are in the top 1% and the top of the top 1% as well. So it's like an escalator transferring money from those who need to borrow, who are generally poor, up to those at the top. So it's a mechanism which creates wealth inequality. But it's also problematic because credit creates claims on the future, that in the future you must pay me back with 10% interest or something. And so you have to produce goods and services which you can sell, and then you can use the money to pay for that. So it predicates the economy upon everlasting growth. And in rich countries, I think it's absurd to continue pursuing growth. The planet is finite. We cannot continue consuming ever more. So within the rich countries, the better off people and the rich, actually need to consume less. We cannot save the planet unless we do that, actually.
Right. And in terms of lending, you talk about public banks rather than private banks. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, generally, where you have public sector banks supporting both private and public sector businesses and cooperative businesses, it's possible for them to have other goals than just the maximization of returns, which is what private banking is all about. So they can actually think about what the economy needs and what is a viable investment, what is a needed investment, and they can be democratically accountable. And in places where you have large numbers of cooperatives, they tend to work together and via a cooperatively owned bank as well, which lends co-ops money when they need to expand or whatever. And, you know, all economies need credit. The question is, how much do you charge for that? In our system, it's basically, well, supply and demand, whatever the creditors can get away with. And okay, they have to think about risk, but that's not the only consideration. It's also power. You know, how much can they extract by extending credit? But yeah, public banks can do things like invest in renewable energy and social housing and often charge lower rates of interest than private banks will and take into account other things than financial gains. So instead of inflating the prices of luxury housing in London, they can invest in social housing or renewable energy.
Well, that would be good to see. And you also talk about worker ownership as being a much more stable way for economies to develop in better directions that we'd all like to see. And that would partly address the short-termism you get from shareholder dominance.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are questions of justice involved in this. And I think we fail to recognise how extraordinary it is that you can work for a company for donkey's years and never have a say in what is done with the revenue of that company. You can't have a say in how the company uses the money which you've helped to bring in. But as a so-called investor, if you've got a lot of money and you buy up shares in that company and get a majority holding, you can do whatever you like with that company. You can strip it of assets, you can raid the pension fund, you can close it down, you can make people redundant. It's extraordinary that the very people who the company depends upon for bringing in revenue by producing goods and services have no say in the running of the company. And because it's become normal, we don't think how peculiar it is, but we need to question these things.
Absolutely. And other than ending financial secrecy and dealing with tax havens, introducing much more progressive taxation, wealth taxes, what would be in your prescription to strengthen economies and deal with inequality?
I would say, one, prioritise taxing unearned income, and especially in property, simply because it can't be moved. You know, land value tax, taxing other forms of unearned income, especially dividends on shares. I mean, one of the reasons shareholders have become so powerful is also because labour has become so weakened. And that's partly as a result of globalisation, competition from cheap labour countries. But one of the things which states can do about that is simply to tax dividends and gains from rises in share prices. And it has to do that, has to do many of these things gradually so as not to crash people's pensions or put homeowners into serious negative equity. But it's got to gradually shift the economy away from one which favours the asset rich at the expense of the asset poor. Housing is extremely important here. Building more social housing, constraining ownership of second homes or stopping it in some cases, and you know, stop supporting buy-to-let, which is just supporting unearned income, basically. And try to constrain private banks in their lending behaviour so that they can't go on increasing the amount people can borrow. In our economy, the asset-rich have become richer at the expense of the asset-poor, people who own very little.
That's it for now. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Professor Sayer's book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, is published by Policy Press, and I strongly encourage you to buy it not from Amazon, but directly from them on www.policypress.co.uk. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.